Hello and welcome to the final episode of the first series of In the Frame. We have a pretty good episode for you today. Today's guest is Carrie Hope Fletcher, who is currently playing Fontaine in the brand new production of Les Miserables at the renovated Sondheim Theatre. Carrie has lots of history with Les Mis. She most recently played Fontaine in the All-Star Les Mis in Concert, having previously played Eponine in the West End and in Dubai. Plus, she also played young Eponine as a child. Carrie has played some incredible roles over the years. She was Veronica in Heathers, Brenda in The Christmasaurus Live, Wednesday in The Addams Family, Trudy Scrumptious in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and Beth in Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. She's also an author, a vlogger, and seemed to be a marathon runner. I don't know how she fits it all in. She's crazy, crazy busy. Earlier this week, I sat down with Carrie backstage at the Sondheim Theatre. She is such a dream interviewee because she has the most infectious energy and is so chatty. We discussed everything from the evolution of her Fontaine dress to the ensemble character she's created for when she's in the show but not playing Fontaine. We also talked about how she's seen the world of social media change in the theatre industry over the past few years, the biggest differences between the shows she starred in, plus how she manages to squeeze in training for a marathon on top of her already crazy busy schedule. Here is the interview. Carrie Hope Fletcher, you're in the frame.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me in the frame.
Well, no, thank you for having me in your boardroom.
I know. I'm in my company manager's office and I feel like the president.
So Carrie is currently sat on this like swivel chair.
Although it is the world's creakiest chair. I don't know if you can hear that. So I'll try not to move.
You should have been like facing the opposite direction when I came in.
With a cat in my lap, yeah.
Carrie will see you now.
Oh god, it's like the wizard from Wicked. The wizard has seen you. Oh no,
this is gonna be very stagey.
Yeah, really stagey. Well, you said to make it stagey, so I thought I'd start with a Wicked quote. Why not?
And yes, that as we mean to go on. So yeah, we're at the beautiful Sondheim Theatre.
Isn't it gorgeous?
It is beautiful. And I was here last week for press night and I was just kind of like running around just trying to look at everything because they've done a really beautiful job. But I believe they've done kind of backstage and dressing rooms and stuff as well.
Yeah.
So is it different to how it was when you were here when it was the Queen?
Hugely so. The room that we're actually in now was my old dressing room. I used to sit in the corner there.
Oh my gosh.
Behind the fridge and the aircon machine. That was my place in the room. But no, now we're just across the hall and we've got a dressing room that half of it used to be the children's dressing room, but then there was a wall.
Wow.
But they've broken through that wall and made it twice as big.
Oh, amazing.
And it's absolutely beautiful. So it's me, Josefina Gabrielle, who plays Madame T, Shan Akko, who's Eponine, and Lily Cahoas, who is Cosette. It's all four of us in there having a rather wonderful time.
They really have kind of literally taken down walls and literally restructured it all.
Yeah, it took a long time to sort of figure out where we were because even just something as simple as painting the floor a different colour really threw me off. I was like, guys, what colour did the floor used to be? I'm sure it was red. And they're going, no, it was always blue. As me scrolling through pictures on my phone, I'm like, guys, it was red. I told you it was red.
It's incredible. And what's amazing for you, obviously, is you've had this amazing Les Mis journey.
It's
so
a bit
you
mad.
Are the only UK actress to have played.
Well, people
young
say
Eponine
this.
And old Eponine.
People say this, but has anyone actually checked?
Well, it says it in your bio in the programme.
Well, the thing is, someone said that in an interview and I went, am I? Oh, all right then. And then every interview past that point, everyone just took that statistic. But I don't think anyone's checked. So when it came to putting my bio in the programme, I was like, can someone check that before it goes in? Because I don't know if that's
true. That was a new fact that I learned this morning from reading your bio.
Well,
it's now a grade in history.
Well, you know, if Les Mis have put it in the bio, then it's got to be true.
But you did quite a few shows as a kid, right?
I did,
to Bang Bang. And I think it's always amazing when you have like known kids who've done West End shows and it's a massive deal and it's so exciting and you hugely idolise the kind of people you're working
massively.
With, right? And they become big kind of inspirations, mm-hmm. I think, in the performer or the person that you go on to become. So do you remember when you were doing Les Mis and when you were doing these other shows, were you kind of like, I want to do that. Like one day I want to come back. I want to play Eponine or I want to come back and do Trudy Scrumptious. Like, was that always like, did that really ingrain that in you?
Yeah, there was no question about it. There was no change in my mind when I was a kid that this is what I was going to carry on doing for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved it so much. And it was kind of the only thing I'm good at as well. even then and now. Like, you asked me to do a maths equation, a science experiment at school, I was rubbish. There was absolutely no way in hell that was I was ever going to be a chemist or a physicist or a mathematician or an accountant. Like, no chance. Singing and acting were the only things that I was vaguely good
at. Slash, like, writing books.
Yeah, I mean, English, I really latched onto, because I love reading. I've loved reading ever since I was a kid. Mm. So, yeah, it was kind of a natural progression to start writing. I've been writing since I was a child. I loved telling stories.
What then really interests me is, so this is the 16th and final episode of this series, and unintentionally, the theme that's kind of woven through this series of interviews is that so many people have had different routes into the industry. Mm. So only a couple of people that I've spoken to on this podcast have actually been to drama school and gone down that traditional route.
It's funny, isn't it?
So many people have had completely different paths in, and I think that it's something that people speak about quite a lot in the industry at the moment. There's kind of all this kind of talk about, from anything, just from star casting, I guess, the conversations that come out of that, and, you know, people who haven't been to drama school, XYZ, and it's actually like, well, no, everyone has their own route, and that's important.
And the thing about performing is that it's subjective. Sometimes it's something that you're not able to learn. It's not as simple as having facts and figures and statistics that you need to remember in order to be good at your job. It's something that's so subjective. And there are some people who just have a real natural flair for it that drama school just can't teach them, because it's something that is ingrained in them since they were a baby.
Yeah. What I've asked a couple of people before is, have there been moments when you're like, oh, I wish I went down the training route? Because I've spoken to some people who've been like, maybe once they've thought that, and they're like, oh, I feel like I'm up my depth, someone's going to find me out. But then they're like, actually, you know, they've found situations have been like, I'm really happy with my route. I wouldn't be able to do this performance if I hadn't had these experiences that I wouldn't have had if I'd have gone to drama school.
Yeah, I mean, because I've been doing it since I was a child. When I got back into it as an adult, it felt like I was just coming back to something that I already knew so well. I didn't feel out of place, and I didn't feel like I didn't know what I was doing. There were certain things that had changed, because now I'm an adult and I'm doing 8 shows a week instead of 3 shows a week, and, you know, little bits and pieces that you just learn on the job anyway. But there were people who around me who had been to drama school who weren't taught those things at drama school, because you can't learn them at drama school, because it's something that you just have to learn when you're in the theatre. There are times when I've kind of thought, would anything be different if I had gone to drama school, and what would have happened, and what would I have learned that I probably still don't know now? But the thing is, I will never know. I'll never know. I can't go back in time.
That's not who you are.
It's not who I am, and I'm happy with who I am, and, you know, what's happened since I was 19 years old.
Was it 19 years old? Was that when you...
I was 20 when I was cast.
Wow.
Yeah.
As old Eponine. As old Eponine.
Older Eponine, yeah.
Older's a much better one. Old Eponine.
Old Eponine, yeah.
And then you were Eponine for 3 years, right?
2 years and 8 months.
2 years, 8 months.
Specifically.
And, I mean, I remember that was a really big time for the show, and you had the most phenomenal casting with you.
It was amazing. It was just after the film came out.
Yes.
The film came out in 2012, and suddenly there was a huge new burst of people coming to watch the show, and younger people especially, because as soon as you bring out a movie, you're going to have a younger audience introduced to it. And I think prior to that point, Les Mis had quite an older, respectable audience of theatre goers, and as soon as that film came out and the cast got younger as well, they started casting sort of, you know, people fresh out of drama school, which they'd never really done before. It instantly introduced, you know, sort of between 14 and 20 year olds to Les Mis.
Yeah. And then when you came to your end of that time with that decision to then leave and then to do other things, was that a scary decision? Did it come naturally? How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I'll tell you the story. So I signed on for my first year at Les Mis, and I got to the end of that first year and I was heartbroken. I was like, I really don't want to leave, because I just don't feel like I'm ready to. I have coveted this role all of my life.
Yeah.
And a year just doesn't feel long enough. So when they asked me to stay for an extra year, I was like, this is the best. And I got to the end of my second year and I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to close the door. And then they were like, but, you know, next year's the 30th anniversary, and if you stay, we'll put you on tube posters. And I went, yeah, all right then. So I stayed for an extra 8 months. Me and Rob Houchin. Rob Houchin was my Marius at the time, and we started on the same date and we ended on the same date together.
And you were all over the tube.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was
insane.
Those amazing portraits that were done.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And Peter Lockyer, who was our Valjean, and Céline Schoenmaker, who was Fantine at the time. The photos were just unreal.
And you did go back and do it. You did it in Dubai. At some
I did,
point,
yes,
didn't
and I did
you?
This version in Dubai.
Right, but you were playing Eponine.
I was Eponine again.
Right,
yes.
So you played Eponine in this version. I didn't realise that it was this newer production. I know you did I Dreamed a Dream on your album.
And yes,
was so. At the back of your mind, had you kind of joked with people that one day you could do Fantine? Was
it a little bit.
On your right? Was it something that where you had you, you know, when did you first sing I Dreamed a Dream? I'm going to go, right, this is, I want to, you know, I would love to do this. How did that happen?
Well, when I finished Zeppelin, because I'd been in it for so long, I was like, it's going to be a long time before I even think about auditioning again for another role. But if I were to audition again, who would I audition for? And obviously, I'm too young at the moment to play Madam T, but I want that to be on the cards in like 30 years' time. And I'm not a soprano, and no one wants to hear me screech my way through Cosette. So it's, you know, Fantine is kind of the only role left in Les Mis that I could play. And I think it's, you know, it's such a beautiful role. She goes through such a harrowing journey right at the beginning of the show as well, so you kind of get her story really early on, which is very different to Eponine. And it would mean being in parts of the show that I never got to be in before, even in Fantine's ensemble track, which I never got to
be
in.
I want to ask you all about that in a second.
Oh my god, okay. We'll get there in a minute. I sort of said in the back, you know, there was just a few beginnings of thoughts in my head that was like, Fantine would be fun, maybe, but let's not think about Les Mis for the next 10 years, because you've been in it for ages. Then I got a random phone call at the end of 2018. Is that right? Yeah, the end of 2018, saying, Fantine, thoughts? And I was like, good thoughts. Yes. Okay. And they were like, great. January 4th, Cameron McIntosh wants to see you at his offices. And I was like, okay, this is moving quickly. And they gave me everything, like all of the material that Fantine sings in the whole show. And
so this wasn't an offer that lands on the table.
This was like, you are being thoroughly put through your paces to see if you are ready to play Fantine. I was sent everything, had to learn everything, which was, you know, it's really strange when you've been in a show for so long and yet you have to learn new stuff. You know, I kind of knew, like, I knew I Dreamed a Dream.
Yeah.
But everything else, I was like, I was in the background for this bit. I just used to listen to this on the tannoy. So actually having to, you know, learn new lyrics and new notes that you've never had to sing before. And I had about a week and a half with this material to go over it and learn it and then sing it in front of Cameron McIntosh. And I walked in and it really was a boardroom. It was like a big room with a big long table with about 10 people sat around it, a pianist in the corner, and Cameron McIntosh pulled one of the chairs out and put it in the middle of the room in front of me where I was stood about to sing, and he was like, I'd like to hear A Dream's Dream, thank you very much. I was like, oh god, okay. It was absolutely terrifying.
That is so
scary.
It was
one of the best days ever,
but
it was terrifying.
And then, of course, it went well.
It went well, yes. And 2 days later, I got a call from my agent saying, right, so he liked what he heard. And an offer is now on the table.
So that was January, but when did the concert begin? It wasn't until...
We didn't start rehearsing.
It was late summer, right?
We didn't start rehearsing until July.
So when did you kind of realise the actual scale of what you were going into? Did you know back then when the offer came in that it was going to be all these massive names and be reunited with Michael Ball?
I had no idea who was going to be in the show. And I didn't know for about 3 months until my agent finally caved, because Michael Ball is also with my agent. And she finally caved and was like, you're going to be working with Michael Ball again.
And anyone who doesn't know, you of course did Shitty Shitty Bang Bang together when you were a child.
As I like to remind him, yes, I was his daughter at one point. he's just the nicest man in showbiz. Like, and I say that, you know, I say that to everyone, not because I'm like, it's one of those things that everyone says, you know, how they always say, oh yeah, we're like a family, that kind of, you know, cliche line that everyone always spews. He genuinely is the nicest man in showbiz. I just I want to work with him all the time now.
And I mean, that cast really is just It was outrageous. It was disgusting.
Yeah, it really was.
To go and see Les Mis and have to deal with all these incredible people, it was just too much. It was too much to bear.
And even like Grania Renahan, who was the hair crone in the stage concert, and like the hair crone, for God's sake.
Yeah.
She's Grania Renahan. She was the longest running Fontaine ever in the history of Les Mis.
In the entire ensemble, you had all sorts of just amazing, epic people. It really was. It was a theatrical event.
It really was. There was only two people in the cast who had never been in Les Mis before, and that was Shan Acco and Lily Cahoas, who were Eponine and Cosette.
Everyone else. The entire ensemble, everyone really had done
before. Yeah, everyone.
Before.
Everyone.
The stories that must have been happening backstage.
Oh, goodness, yeah. And I kept forgetting who knew who and who didn't know who, because it was people from the three casts that I'd been in prior to the concert, and the Dubai cast. There were people from the Dubai cast in the show.
Wow.
And then people who I'd never worked with before, but who had worked with the people that I knew because they'd stayed on when I'd left. And it was just a huge amalgamation of all the casts that Les Mis has seen.
That was truly, truly special to see that. I came the night it just happened to be the show's birthday.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We all got champagne at the end. Yep. It was wonderful. We all saying happy birthday. That's one of those really special moments that just isn't going to happen.
No.
But another kind of moment that just isn't going to happen again is then reopening the show at this renovated theatre. So when did that offer come in? Was that straight away? Did it take a while?
That was the same audition. So when I was auditioning, I knew that I was auditioning for the concert and the Sondheim kind of collectively. But it was so bizarre because it felt like forever away. I mean, I knew in January that I would be opening at the Sondheim in January the following year, which was just madness.
That's so unusual to have that kind of level of...
Yeah.
Offer on the table.
Yeah,
for
and you know, I feel very lucky because there are so many times when you're coming to the end of a contract and like, oh God, I don't know what's coming next. Just the fear of unemployment looming. So it was nice to kind of have an offer on the table that meant I would be in work for a little while. But yeah, it felt like so long away that there was no way I could even start thinking about what it would be like at the Sondheim and what that production would be and who I'd be working with. Everything was kind of just gearing towards the concert because that was going to be such a big event in itself.
Of course.
So then we started rehearsing. We doubled up.
Yeah, so this is what blows my mind. Because anyone who doubles up, sometimes you're in a show and you're rehearsing for your next show. So that is exhausting. You might be in Les Mis and rehearsing for fan tunes during the day. And that is seriously hardcore. But what blows my mind is that you were performing Les Mis at night and then you were rehearsing for a different production of it during the day. Like you have like Bradley Jaden, who was rehearsing a different role. So he was playing Honduras and he was rehearsing for Javert. But you were literally playing Fontaine and then rehearsing it during the day, but a slightly different version of it.
That's
a situation that I can't imagine anyone's been in. How did that work?
It was so weird and so like, honestly, I look back at it and there were only six of us who were doubling up,
right?
And I look back at it and I'm just like, guys, how did we get through that? How did we do that? Because we were rehearsing at Three Mills, which is a studio in Bromley by Bow, which is very far away for everyone, I've realised. There is no sort of easy, unless you live in Bromley by Bow, it's the hardest place to get to. We were rehearsing from 10 till 5 during the day, then we'd have an hour to get across London and get to the Gielgud next door and grab food and then be in the theatre by 6:15 for warm-up. It was madness. We just sort of lived... breathed and
we're like direction nights. I mean, in some ways, was it kind of, I guess maybe you were developing your character during the day, learning new things about her, which you could almost apply, but then you can't, the direction and stuff, you kind of had to just leave at the door when you got in.
Yeah, and there was, there are slight changes, like, oh no, you don't sing that line in this production, that's actually given to someone else. So then having to remember in the evening that, oh no, I do have to sing that line because I sing that line in this production. It's almost harder when you're playing the same role in two different productions, because there will be slight changes that you really have to stay on top of. You can't just settle and sort of be like, no, I know this, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's, there were some times when I really had to have my brain switched on. So I was like, oh God, it's me, I need to sing now, even though I'm not singing in the morning.
I can't get my head around it. But this production is beautiful. And I was saying I'd seen it on Broadway. It's toured the UK. And it's this new, Lawrence Connor's new kind of reimagining of it. And there's some big differences and there's some tiny differences. And what I like as well is that they haven't stopped working on this production, have they? It has kind of evolved, and Cameron's been sending us some special things just for this production. So for people who haven't seen it yet, explain what it's like. What can people expect from this kind of new generation of Les Mis?
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4-6 Success Filmmaking. 4-6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4-6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Okay, well, that's a big question. That's pressure.
This is the million-dollar question.
Yeah. The way I always describe this production is that it looks like a painting, and it is based on Victor Hugo's watercolours. We have them as projections in the background. And it just looks like a painting. All of the colours are completely different. All of the characters kind of have different costumes.
I love the costume design.
Stunning.
I absolutely love. I love your dress. Actually, that blue is just beautiful.
It's just that dress. we've had lots of conversations about Fontaine's dress, because the original dress that was on the poster outside of the Gielgud for the entire run that I was there only ever saw the dress rehearsal, because Cameron said it looked too glamorous, and it did, to be fair, but it was stunning, and they had to prize me out of it because I loved it so much. But he decided that 2 days before we were due to open, so a whole new dress had to be made very quickly for the opening of the Gielgud. But then that dress was like a dark blue dress that then was too dark for this set at the Sondheim, so then they had to remake exactly the same dress in a lighter blue. So
in
the last 6 or 7 months, I've had 3 different Fontaine dresses.
But now everyone's happy.
They've settled on this one. But the material from the first glamorous dress is used in Lovely Ladies. So she still gets a little bit of a preview.
Fun fact. Now people can rewatch that scene kind of differently. I love the whole kind of, the staging is, there's just little moments that you didn't get from before.
No.
There's slightly, the scenes are kind of reimagined, and there's no revolve.
There's no revolve. That is the biggest change. And the thing with Les Mis is it's such a dark show, lighting-wise. There's bits of it that are very dark, and the stage is sort of set in a way that the back of the stage, when you're in the background, is much, much darker than what the audience are seeing, so you can really hide in the background. But that meant when you had a turning revolve, a spinning stage, jumping off the back of that thing was absolutely terrifying. It was like, you know, you felt like Daredevil every time you had a scene to do. This is sound check, by the way.
For what? If anyone can't hear, there's some music in the background, but it's definitely not I Dreamed a Dream. It's definitely not Les Mis.
I think if one of those knobs there will turn it down, I'm not sure which one, though, because this isn't my room.
This one.
There you go. There you go.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, band.
Beautiful music. What were we saying?
The revolve.
The biggest change is the fact that the revolve has gone. And I do miss it, because I did really enjoy feeling quite...
You were a revolve fan.
Yeah, I was a revolve fan, I will be honest. But then when I was in this version of the show in Dubai without the revolve, there's just so much in it that makes more sense. You know, if it could be like a practical thing that just makes more sense, that just helped us out as a cast.
Yeah.
And there are things in the show that sort of make more sense. Like Javert's suicide is my favourite bit in this version of the show. Because, you know, as much as I loved the revolve, the last version did used to make me laugh when Javert had to stop, drop and roll off the stage in his death scene. It used to make me giggle a little bit. And that scene in this version is so epic and so beautiful and so cleverly done.
It's very dramatic.
It's very dramatic, and I love it. I can't imagine Les Mis not having that now.
Ultimately, for me, I think the star of Les Mis is the music, and it is the material. And I mean, as proved at the concert, people can just stand and sing it.
Yep.
I mean, when you go and see a, you know, a Best of Musicals concert, act one always ends with something from Les Mis.
Yeah.
And it always gets the most incredible response from the audience because that music is so incredible.
It's
and
stunning.
The material is stunning. So, you know, when everyone's talking about the Revolve and their outrage, I kind of think, you know, the Revolve was fabulous and it had its moment and it, you know, should have won an Olivier. But it, you know, the show lives on and things change, things get refreshed, and it's exciting that people have a new excuse to come back and see the show, not that they needed one. But no, this production is fabulous.
It's beautiful.
It's really wonderful. And tell me about then what your track is like. So what people who really don't realise, and this has been way back when, since the beginning of Les Mis.
You know, this is like since Patti LuPone.
Exactly. Well, Patti LuPone, there's stories about her, isn't there, like not turning up to rehearsal so she could avoid being put into certain ensemble scenes, which I love. So what's your ensemble track like when you're not Fontaine?
So my ensemble track, she's called Patrice. She's got a
wow.
name. Oh yeah, we've gone full out, we're feeling. Yeah. So yeah, for people who don't know, all of the principals, apart from Valjean and Javert, because they are in it from beginning to end, there's no time for them to be in the ensemble. So Eponine, Cosette, Madame T, Mr. T, Marius and Andras, I think that's everyone, they are all in the ensemble during the first 40 minutes of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all go upstairs and get ready, sort of around lovely ladies' time, to get dressed into their principal character costumes, and then they come down into Paris, which is pretty much when everyone's introduced. I'm the other way around. Because my Fontaine's part is at the beginning of the show, so as soon as Fontaine sadly dies, I then go upstairs, and then I've got about 25 minutes to have a quick cup of tea, get all of my death makeup off of my face, and then I get dressed into Patrice. I've got a little dark brown wig, little hat.
I did try to look for you, but I didn't actually spot you.
I'm always at the back. Okay. I come back for one day more, which I'm kind of gutted about because I really wanted to be in the People's Song. But because Fontaine used to be in the People's Song back at the Queen's, but in this version she's not. So
and
I'm
do you enjoy
in
it? Do you enjoy it? I mean, doing a number like One Day More as part of an ensemble, like, what do you feel? What that response in the audience? It's like the ultimate ensemble number, isn't it?
Yeah, and there hasn't been a night so far in my whole time at Les Mis when the audience hasn't gone absolutely bonkers at the end. Because it's just a show-stopping number.
Mm.
It's the show-stopping number, if anything. It's incredible. And like you said, if ever there's like a concert that's just full of a variety of different musical theatre songs, they will always end Act 1 or even just Act 2, the whole show with One Day More, because it's
absolutely just
brilliant. Everyone knows it and everyone loves it.
Mm.
So yeah, to be part of that and see it from a different perspective as well, it's brilliant.
Mm.
And it's so much fun. And it's nice to kind of have my track, you know, my big part, my Fontaine part at the beginning, so
over
all the pressure's out of the way, and then I can enjoy being part of the show, and then I get a cheeky little comeback at the end. It's nice.
And I'm going to gush for a moment. So I Dreamed a Dream, I think, is a stunning moment.
Isn't it beautiful?
Moment. The lighting. It's been... Actually, this theatre is very intimate. I've forgotten how intimate the Sondheim is. And I Dreamed a Dream, it is just you on stage, and you really feel that connection. That's one of my favourite moments of the show this time around. It really stood out for me. It really felt different, and I think that was to do with the intimacy and the lighting, and of course your incredible performance.
Oh, thank you very much.
So it is quite exposing, isn't it?
Well, it's so funny you say that, because I saw Rob Houchin the other day, who said it was my Marius. I saw he came to press night to watch, and he said to me, he was like, oh, I love that Fontaine's on her own now when she sings I Dreamed a Dream. And I was like, Rob, she was always on her own. Like, that hasn't changed. She was always the only person on stage.
Yeah.
And I think that is to do with new lighting and the new staging and the new, you know, the set and the intimacy, that it does feel there, like whoever's up
the
on the stage,
is it basically
feels like
bare, isn't it?
Yeah, you just get sucked into whoever stood on stage, because it is just sort of a black box, especially at that point when there is no set, there's nothing else on stage. It's like On My Own is the same.
Yeah.
There's nothing else on stage. It's just Shan singing her heart out. And yeah, it is just one of those sets, and especially with the lighting, when it's just one person in a spotlight, you just get sucked into whatever they're doing.
And have you enjoyed kind of finding that song in your voice? Because now you've done it so many times, it must really just be there, but what was it like to get, you know, get around that song and get to know it and and find your way of doing it.
It is a bit terrifying when you're told that you're going to be singing one of the world's most iconic songs, because I Dream to Dream it is, especially since Susan Boyle sang it on Britain's Got Talent.
People I know.
Who still don't even know what Lame is, they will know I Dream to Dream. Mm. So it was a bit daunting thinking, oh God, I've got to sing that on stage every night, and people know it from the opening chords, and they sort of like, you can see them like get ready for it. So there is a lot of pressure singing that song every night. But then when you think of it just in the context of her story, and I have to think of it just within the context of her story,
which is so, I mean, forlorn. It's the emotional height of her story, like,
yeah, and which is hilarious because it's before she really goes downhill. So you think that that's, you know, when she's that point when she sings I Dream to Dream, that's the point when she's lost everything, but she's still got quite a long way to fall.
It's a tough ride.
So yeah, when you really sort of get your teeth into it, and I had a one-on-one session with Lawrence Connor, our director, to talk it through and, you know, go through the real ins and outs of every line and every lyric and how she's really feeling at that point and what she's lost already. It's really intense. It's quite a taxing show emotionally for everyone in this show. I mean, you know, the title kind of gives it away. Everyone's pretty miserable or ends up miserable, apart from the Thénardiers who end up on their feet.
They live their best life from beginning to end. But thank God, because that's what we need. You know,
yes, there has to be some sort of comic relief at least.
I think, it's an incredible moment. And I just think there's so many moments that people, when they come and see this new production, they'll be surprised by. And I think I Dream to Dream is a massive part of that. Mm. I want to talk about some of the other kind of bits and pieces that you've done.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
We did an interview before. I think it's when you were in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Right.
And what's so interesting is even, you know, since then, that was quite early on after you'd left Lame Mis the first time around.
That was right after I left.
You'd done like Roar the World, hadn't you? And then you were straight into Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah.
And since then, you've really managed to do so many completely different things. Mm. And you've really kind of, it's almost like we're kind of grown with you, you know, seeing your different roles. Kind of going into that post Les Mis, post Eponine phase, did you kind of have to kind of be like to people, no, I can do this too, I can do this too, I can do a legit role, I can do a big belty role? Because it is those credits are so completely different.
Yeah.
And I'm just interested if that was like a conscious decision for you, or if it just worked out like that.
It kind of just worked out like that. I mean, there were sort of things on my bucket list of roles that I really wanted to do. But I never really, now that you've said that, I've never really thought about how different they are.
Because strategy.
Yeah, I've always kind of thought about their similarities more than anything.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's funny, one of the questions that I get asked the most online is, you know, when I do like Q&As stuff on Instagram, people are always like, you know, if all of your characters were in a room together, which one would be, you know, who would get on with each other or who would hate each other? So I feel like I've always thought about their similarities rather than their differences. And even now I kind of think there's more similarities than there are differences, I guess.
I guess in terms of like personality, like, I don't know.
In terms of character.
In terms of character, but I guess I'm thinking like technical. Like you're full on belting
voice type,
and heathers. And then in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, you're this like angelic, floaty, like lovely voice.
Yeah.
And that's like skill set wise, that's completely different. And not everybody who could play Judy Scrumptious would then go on to play Veronica. That's just not set in people's casting.
Oh, I take that as a huge compliment. Thank you. No, thank you very much. I do. Chitty felt like... It felt relaxing voice wise because it was nice to just play something that, you know, didn't have to wreck her voice every night. and she was so much fun. I really miss Chitty. Chitty's the show I think that I miss the most because I did it for 5 months and that was it. And the cast was incredible, and, you know, working alongside Lee Mead and Jason Manford as my Caractacus Pottses. It was such a wonderful, fun, magical thing to revisit, especially after being in it as a child. It was a lot of fun to come back and play Truly after having played Jemima. And going from that, I guess, to Wednesday. I mean, Wednesday is obviously going to be different from everyone because she's barking mad and very dark and likes killing woodland creatures, which I don't think I'll ever play a part that likes to do that again.
She's an amazing character.
She's incredible. I had so much fun playing Wednesday. And that was, like I said, I kind of had a bucket list of roles that I really wanted to play. Truly being one of them because I, you know, was in it as a child and heard that it was coming back and really wanted to try my hand at playing Truly. And it just so happened that when I was in Chitty, the same producer got the rights to The Addams Family. So he knocked on my dressing room door one day and was like, and I'd done a concert with Andrew Lipper in 2014, like really early on in my Eponine days.
Who, of course, wrote The Addams Family.
He wrote The Addams Family. And Andrew Lipper approached my agent and said, have you got any female singers who would be interested in singing in my concert? And my agent put my name forward and sent him West End Live videos of me singing on my own. And he went, yeah, fine, just give her Pulled from The Addams Family. Like, really, just like, cash. She'll do. Like, you know, not, you know, it wasn't like I was handpicked. It was kind of like a, yeah, she sounds fine. And so I sang at this concert. And after it finished, he said, if The Addams Family ever comes to the UK, I want you as Wednesday. And I was like, oh, that's lovely of him to say, but he doesn't mean it. Because what are the chances that he'll even remember my name in 2 weeks' time? You know, people say things like that all the time, and you could just have to take it for what it is.
It's lovely. The meaning is always wonderful.
Yeah, the sentiment is beautiful. Thank you so much. But that's never going to happen, but thank you. And yeah, so it was 2016. It was 2 years later that I got a knock on my dressing room door from the producer of Chitty. And he was like, yeah, so I've got the rights to The Addams Family and Andrew Lipper's asked for you personally to audition next week. Are you free? And I was like, oh, okay. And I was in Canterbury at the time. So I had to travel back from Canterbury to the American Church on Tottenham Court Road and audition for the director and like the panel of people, of creatives who were working on it. And again, about 2 weeks later, I got a call being like, yeah, so Wednesday. Happy with that? I was like, oh my god, this is crazy.
Insane.
Crazy.
And then what I think is kind of between like doing something like Addams Family and also like Heathers is they were both new productions.
Yes.
So there's some people might not realise, but you know, that's a completely different thing, isn't it? Because rather than following a track or following what's come before, you're literally able to put your own stamp on it. Especially, I don't know about Addams Family, but especially with Heathers, it was this new reworked version of the show.
Yes.
So it really was almost like a brand new musical that you were kind of getting to be a part of. So how do you enjoy those processes? How do you enjoy, what are the main differences for you, and what do you get most excited about when you're kind of really getting to create and really getting to do something brand new?
The difference between The Addams Family and Heathers was that The Addams Family had a completely different creative team, whereas Heathers had the same creative team.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so with The Addams Family, it was literally like a blank slate. Everything was new. We had a completely new set, a completely new set designer, costume designer. The only person who was the same was Andrew Lipper, who came in to be with us in rehearsals for the last few weeks before we opened in Edinburgh. And that was a lot of fun because it kind of felt like there was no pressure because it was just a blank slate and whatever you did was going to be okay because there's nothing else that came before it in our heads or in the creatives' heads. Whereas with Heathers, it kind of felt like we already had a blueprint to follow. And there were times in the rehearsal room where we actually just crowded around a little computer screen to watch the old version of the show, like an archive that they had.
Wow.
Because with something like Heathers, there were moments that were so specific that they knew worked really well. Like there's a song called Fight For Me, where there's like a whole slow motion punch up between JD and the two like beefcakes that are Kurt and Ram. And there was no way that could change because it killed every night. It's like one of the funniest moments in the show. So there were certain parts in the show that just couldn't change because they worked too well. And because we had the same creative team, we could. And also because Heathers is such a cult show and it's a cult movie as well, it's so bizarre that both of them have become their own entities, kind of individual of each other. A lot of pressure came with Heathers. That show honestly terrified me and still terrifies me a little bit.
I mean, the kind of response for the world of the online fandom of that show is unreal. And it was, I mean, on one hand, it's really exciting because it was bringing so many new people to theatre and getting so many people so excited, which I think is so important for this industry and something that, you know, we should be encouraging. But at the same time, I did an interview with Paul Taylor Mills in this series, and he was kind of saying, he was almost like having to police it. You know, he was like, how do you police it? It was, as a producer, it was an entirely new challenge for him and something that he hadn't experienced before. So tell me, how do you deal with that pressure?
Well, it's funny because our director, Andy Fickman, who is one of the most amazing humans on the planet, he's incredible, as a human being, let alone a director. He's just amazing. And he kept saying to us, he was like, you don't know what's going to hit you. Like, you don't know what's coming. It's going to be crazy. And we were like, yeah, sure.
And you know your online world. Yeah. Like, you know, you would think that you were pretty clued up.
Yeah, I wasn't.
You know one or two things about social media, like.
A little bit, but I was not prepared. I was just not, none of us were, for the onslaught of fans and corn nuts, as they're called, and how responsive they would be to our version of Heather's. It was, yeah, it was so overwhelming and so exhausting and so challenging. And I always kind of reference Heather's as my biggest challenge yet within a role. Not only for the fact that it was very vocally demanding, more vocally demanding than any show I've ever been in, and more physically demanding because there was, you know, fights and dancing, and I was the first one on stage and the last one off stage. Like, there was a 4-minute solo called Kindergarten Boyfriend, and that was the only song I was offstage for in the entire show.
And it's extreme belting.
It's a lot.
And like I say, so physically, it was it's a massive, massive role. But then I guess like conquering it and then doing that 8 times a week kind of end the run stronger, yeah. Right? You're like, right, well, now I can do anything.
Definitely. And I think the moment for me that was so terrifying was I got 6 weeks into the 8-week run of Heather's at the Other Palace.
Yeah.
And at this point, we knew it was going to be going to the Haymarket, had its West End transfer. And Andrew Lloyd Webber had come in and said he felt like Veronica needed a new solo song at a certain point in the show. He wanted her to have like an 11 o'clock number. And on the Monday, I get called in and I'm told that there's a new song called I Say No that's been written for me to sing as Veronica. And we'd rehearse it on the Thursday and it would go into the show on the Friday. And I was like, what? I'm sorry. Okay. And I was stood there during a song called Lifeboat, which is the song right before I would have to sing I Say No. And no one knew it was coming. Like, it wasn't announced. No one knew. And the audience is full of people who know this show backwards.
Yeah.
So as soon as the opening chords start of a song that they haven't heard because it's not on the soundtrack, I watched the faces of the audience, like, freak out. And I was freaking out. When I was stood there during Lifeboat, I'm sort of linked arms with Jamie Moscato, who plays JD. And he whispered to me, he was like, Carrie, I haven't heard you breathe in about 3 minutes. You need to breathe. Because I was just petrified, absolutely petrified. Because not only was I about to sing a new song and I was terrified of forgetting the notes or the lyrics, because I learned it on Monday and it's now Friday, is also the fact that I'm singing a new song in a beloved musical that 350 people all know to a T, and they're going to know that this is different. It was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. But it then also added to, because I Say No is not an easy song to sing. So then adding that to an already monstrous sing was challenging, to say the least.
But it's an incredible song.
It's unreal. I couldn't believe it when they gave it to me and they were like, so this song's been written for you. I was like, that's epic.
And how do you, because like I say, you know your social media well, you know you're, that's a massive part of what you do. But I guess then throughout your career, has then having to deal with that as an actress kind of been different and had different knock-on effects? Because, well, I guess, I don't know, when you're putting yourself out there online, you're still putting yourself out there, but when you're putting yourself out on stage, it's so exposing in a different way.
I find it kind of more the other way around. I prefer hiding behind a character. And if
like,
someone,
like escapism, yeah,
and so if someone's like, oh, I really hated the way that you, like, I don't know, if someone sort of slates the show or the character that I'm playing, or even the way that I play the character, I'm kind of able to distance myself from it, just be like, oh, well, okay.
Right, if they say like a video you've done or a
yeah,
book you've written,
me.
Then you, there's no one else.
Yeah, it's coming straight for me and there's nothing to sort of deflect being hurt.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way around. So almost it's kind of makes the kind of theatre side of it almost a bit easier.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, you know, kind of there's producers now kind of cottoned on to social media thing and there's more kind of pressure. Sometimes some shows you're not allowed to post any pictures. It all has to be top secret. Other shows they want you to post stuff. I guess even throughout your kind of career, I think I started West End Frame similar time to you to start Les Mis. I started West End Frame 2012. And to see the way like social media and and things have just changed in this industry. It's completely transformed. I mean, if I started a podcast in 2012, like PRs and producers would be like, what? No, yeah. We're not doing that. And now, yeah. You know, now people are cottoning on to that. There's different avenues and people are consuming media a different way. How have you seen it change, and how do you, you know, find those changes as an actress?
Well, there's certain shows that just don't need the PR. Like Les Mis is the longest running show in the world. Everyone loves it. It's going to be sold out regardless of whether you've got names in the show or not. Yeah. So when I first started in Les Mis, it was like strictly no vlogging, strictly no posting any photos. You know, you're not allowed at all. Big no-no.
Big cross,
no. And then sort of as the years went on, I started sneaking my camera into the theatre and filming stuff like just in the dressing room and nowhere else. Or me coming into the show and then there'd be like a big gap and then me leaving the show. And then I got one day, about 2 years into me being in Les Mis, got called into the company office and she was like, my company manager was like, you're allowed to post stuff. Like we've been given the go ahead that you can now post a few things backstage. And I was like, oh, okay. So then started doing loads more videos backstage. But then there's shows like Heather's where I had a social media meeting before I started in the show with their marketing team. Cause they were like, we'd love you to post videos. Is there anything that we can help with? We're thinking of doing something called Big Fun Friday. Would you be interested in that? So, you know, there's other shows that need the PR or want the PR and so are happy to work with you. And if there's someone in the cast who, you know, has sort of a flair for that kind of thing, then they'll completely embrace it.
Absolutely. I think it's important because, you know, it comes back to what I was saying before about getting new people into theatre. And to like Heather's, you know, that did an incredible job, I think, for the West End, for the whole kind of industry.
Well, the point of casting names in a show, even if they don't have social media presence, like, you know, star casting as being an age-old thing, you get like a soap star to front a cast, it's to boost sales. So then, you know, social media is just completely revolutionized that, because now you're getting people who are like reality TV stars or, you know, influencers. I cringe. Influencers who are now, you know, helping to promote shows, which is great if they're good at their job. If they're not, it goes a bit sideways and kind of does more harm for a show than it could do good. But that's a different conversation.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head, though. It's about certain soaps. Like, oh, a soap has been cast in a show. And I'm like, yes, Jenna Russell is the biggest star in Theatre Land. She's incredible. She was in EastEnders for 2 years. But she's not a soap, you know. But somebody may have never done a musical in their life and then suddenly they're, you know, doing this massive role that's out of their depth. And then I think that's when it
kind of harms the industry more than
And people can be quick to jump to a conclusion.
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, like you said, you know, they're like, oh, they've cast a famous actor to be in a musical. It's like, yes, because they're a famous actor. That's literally their job. Mm. Like, their job is to act, and now they're acting on stage instead of the screen. Where are you confused? Mm. But yeah, when it gets dangerous is when it's like a reality TV star who's never acted and never had an interest to act in their life or sing, and it's purely for ticket sales. But then I feel like it just goes wrong, because surely then you're losing ticket sales, no? I'm now talking about things that I don't 100% know about.
But
so.
I think, I'm agreeing with you. One thing I want to ask quickly is about, I love your album and those concerts.
You.
And I mean, that album is like just the biggest like feast of, I mean, I could tell we have the same taste. It's like all like, you know, those songs that people love. Is that something you kind of want to do more of and do more kind of like evenings with Carrie Hope Fletcher?
Oh, God. Oh, no.
How did you find doing those shows at Cadogan Hall?
They were incredible, but they were terrifying. And the whole, like, the album and the concert were mostly driven by my friend Darren Bell, who is a producer. He's a photographer. He's amazing.
Just a bit of a genius.
Very clever. He's very, very smart and very good at what he does. But yeah, originally he approached me about doing a concert and I was like, oh God, because that's my worst nightmare. Like I said, I hate being on stage as myself.
Right.
It's awful. Just no. My usual answer would be no, a resounding no. But then I don't know, he just caught me on a good day and I was like, do you know what? Go on, I'll face my fear and I'll do it. So we started planning the concerts, but then he was like, how would you feel about doing an album alongside the concert? And that sounded like more fun than doing the concerts, because that meant I could just have a play with people who I've never played with before, like Tom Barnes, who orchestrated the album, and he just did such a brilliant job. My criteria for the album was that I want it to be filled with songs that people know really well, like I Dreamed a Dream, like Somewhere That Screamed from Little Shop of Horrors.
Mm. It's Smash, some Anastasia.
Yeah, exactly. Songs that people know really well, especially stagey people will know really well. But when it begins, I want them to go, what song's this? I want them to not know what the song is when the opening chords start, and then be surprised when I start singing lyrics and a melody that they know really, really well. And Tom Barnes just absolutely smashed it.
Mm. And I think that's such a passion project, isn't it? You can just show people. It's another medium for you of showing people who you are and what
Completely.
You love and what you want to do. We need some more causes. You're so busy, there's like no time. And one thing that you're doing this marathon.
Oh my god, I know.
Of everything else you're
doing.
What
have I done?
It is so incredible.
I'm so excited about it. And I think it's because when I talk about, like when I was talking about Heathers and I'm like, oh, you know, it was my biggest challenge to date, I say that already knowing that I can sing and I can act. So that's kind of half the battle won, really. It's just a heightened version of singing and acting, or, you know, more singing and acting than I've ever had to do before in one production. But with running the marathon, I'm not a runner. This is coming from someone who used to say, I don't move if I don't have to. Like, I'm not great at sports or exercising or any of that jazz.
If only it was more jazz, then maybe I would do more.
Yeah. So it all began with my sister-in-law. She signed up to the Vitality 10K, and she was asked to do it by Bryony Gordon. And she didn't want to do it on her own because it required running in your underwear, because it was for a campaign called Celebrate You, which is all about embracing exercise no matter what shape or size you are. Mm-hmm. Anyone can exercise, regardless. And I was like, yeah, 10K. Yeah, I can do that. Fine. And then I went out for my first run, and it was like a spoof of someone doing their first run. I got halfway down the road, like not even 2 minutes down the road, and was doubled over, not able to breathe, because I got cocky and was like, yeah, I can do this, and started running way too fast. And I kind of had a personal vendetta against it then. I was like, no, I am going to do this, and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. So I started like properly training, and I have been running since April. I had a little hiatus when I was doubling up with the Les Mis's.
Understandably,
there was no time.
You were running to the theatre, it sounds like that was your run.
But then I picked it up just before New Year's, and decided.
And when is this? When is the marathon?
April 26th.
And what are you doing that day? You're not doing two shows, are you?
No, it's the day after I do two shows. So I've got a hiatus from Les Mis for 7 weeks, and hilariously, it coincides with my first week back. So I'll have my first eight-show week back at Les Mis, and then I'm running the marathon on the Sunday. I'm running the big half as part of my training. The big half is in London as well. And that is March the 1st, the day before I fly to Japan for a concert.
Oh, gosh.
So I will be sleeping on that flight, that 12-13 hour flight.
No films for you.
No. I will be completely conked out with my legs elevated up against a window.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I could just go on forever.
I know. I feel like we're kind of having to cut our conversation short.
Apparently, it's been like 53 minutes.
Well, I've had a blast.
It's been lovely. Good luck with Les Mis.
Thank you.
Good luck with the marathon.
Yeah, I need more luck for the marathon, I think.
I can't wait to see what comes next. And guess what? This is a secret. You can't tell any other people about this. I have a present for you.
Oh my goodness.
And this is the news. So people are listening. We have another podcast called The West End Frame Show, and I give all my co-hosts a little present on that. But I know that it's in the frame until now, but you can't tell the previous people.
Okay, I won't.
But you've got a little box.
Oh my goodness. Oh, hang on. Oh goodness, I can't get out with one hand. There we go. Oh, thank you so much. It's a mug that says West End Frame on it. Oh, I love it.
What's this mug? What does this mug say on
here? My mug says, I will not compare myself to a stranger on Instagram.
Oh, well, that's actually a very important mug
yes,
to have.
Yes, it is.
But I mean, West End Frame mug,
but
it's
now
very
I have
happy
two.
Beside it.
There we go. Thank you so much.
No
I
worries.
Love it.
Thank you, Carrie. Les Mis is currently booking at the Sondheim Theatre until the 17th of October. Thank you so much to Carrie for taking time out to record this episode of In the Frame. It was honestly such a pleasure to sit down with her for a chat. She's a total dream. That's a wrap for Series 1 of In The Frame. If you've just joined us, make sure you go back and check out all of the early episodes from this series. I've had the best time chatting to all of our amazing guests. There have been some truly fascinating conversations. I've loved every minute of it. If you've enjoyed it In The Frame, it would be amazing if you could take 2 seconds to leave us a little rating, maybe even write a little review. And if you're just joining us, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you also check out our other podcast, The West End Frame Show, so you can stay up to date with everything going on in theatre land. Head over to westendframe.co.uk for more info about all of our crazy, exciting, busy podcasting adventures. You can also find West End Frame on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'll be back very soon to kick off a brand new series of In The Frame. But until then, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for all of your support. And I can't wait to dive in and get stuck into Series 2 very, very soon. Thank you.